studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Wednesday, July 15th, 2015. Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, details the myriad ways in which women are being thrown under the bus in her new book. And actor and activist Mimi Kennedy joins us in studio to discuss the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Courtney Morris. She's an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Sonali.
A day after the U.S. struck a historic deal with Iran, after decades of hostilities, the Republican Party predictably threw cold water on it. House Speaker John Boehner said the agreement is, quote, going to hand a dangerous regime billions of dollars in sanctions relief while paving the way for a nuclear Iran. If it's as bad a deal as I think it is at this point, we'll do everything we can to stop it, end of quote. President Obama seemed equally determined to pass the bill, saying, I will veto any legislation that prevents the successful implementation of this deal. This is not the time for politics or posturing. Tough talk from Washington does not solve problems, says the president. The deal, which delays Iran's ability to obtain a nuclear weapon by at least 15 years, needs to be ratified by Congress. A recent poll of Americans on the deal found that a slim majority, 51%, wants the U.S. to have diplomatic ties with Iran. Courtney, don't the Republicans risk looking like fools by refusing to pass this deal?
Well, quite possibly. I mean, it's apparent even at this early stage in the announcement that the negotiations have gone through, that, you know, the tide of public opinion, both nationally and internationally, has been overwhelmingly positive about this agreement. Several states in the Middle East, including Iraq and Oman, as well as several of our European allies, have stated very clearly their support for this deal. And there's also been a large amount of support from civil society, both in the United States and abroad, including from more progressive organizations. And I was reading this morning that the Institute for Policy Studies was talking about how important this deal is, because it will not only allow the United States to keep an eye, or the international community rather, to keep an eye on nuclear development in Iran, but that it also really marks a turning point in our relationship with that country and in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. As we've seen in the last few years, the situation in the Middle East has completely deteriorated, and this kind of diplomacy really, you know, presents the possibility that we'll be able to treat Iran as an ally in dealing with the problems that we have created in the region. So this is a hugely important deal, and one that many people support, even if Republicans can't seem to get on board.
And just as Greece was agreeing to deal with Germany on solving its fiscal crisis through more cuts in exchange for cash, the International Monetary Fund this morning said it would not agree to a deal unless it included debt relief. The move throws a wrench into the EU's ability to strong-arm Greece. The IMF's report on Greece, called the Debt Sustainability Analysis, shows that the nation's debt will peak to about 200% of its income within just 2 years. The need for a writing off of at least part of Greece's debt is what Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has been requesting for weeks. Greece's parliament votes on the plan today, but in an indication of how serious the split within the ruling Syriza party may be, Deputy Finance Minister Nadia Valvani has just resigned over the austerity package. She said, quote, it is impossible to continue being a member of the government. Now, Courtney, there is a split within Syriza, but might there also be a split within the group of creditors to Greece?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no clear agreement between member states of the Eurozone and institutions like the IMF. And it's been actually a bit refreshing to see that the IMF finally seems to be understanding that the gospel of free market fundamentalism doesn't actually work. We've seen that the outcomes of the austerity program in Greece have really been disastrous, and that the bailout that's being negotiated, I think, really has to develop a long-term strategy for allowing Greece to rebuild wealth, rather than focusing on the short-term goal of debt repayment. And many of the bailouts that that Greece has received have focused almost exclusively on the repayment of debt, to the exclusion of cultivating more long-term strategies for economic growth in the country. And so this is an encouraging sign, although late from the IMF. It is encouraging to see that they are understanding that this is a problem. But of course, it still remains to be seen how all of this is going to play out in terms of whether Greece is going to accept the terms of the bailout that are set out by the Eurozone, and whether the Eurozone, particularly Germany, which is the most powerful actor in this whole situation, whether Germany is really going to allow debt relief to enter into the conversation.
Right. And finally, a judge ordered the release of a 2-year-old video of a shooting by Los Angeles police officers from the Southern California city of Gardena. The city paid $4.7 million in settlement to the family of Ricardo Diaz Zeferino, who was killed by police. Media outlets like the LA Times sued for the video's release, and the city fought to prevent them from being made public. The video shows Mr. Zeferino and another man standing in place with their hands in the air. Apparently, they were confused because one of them had actually called the police about a stolen bicycle. When the three officers in question arrived, they pointed their guns at the men and then shot Zeferino 8 times. The other man was also shot once but survived. The city attorney found no wrongdoing in the actions. Courtney, if it weren't for media outlets suing to get this video, we wouldn't see it. What do you make of this horrific incident?
I mean, there are really no words for this, but I think that, you know, one of the things that we're finally beginning to see is that the movement that we've seen emerging over the last year demanding more transparency and accountability around the question of police abuse is really bolstered by having access to these kinds of this kind of evidence, being able to see what the police are doing and what's actually taking place in these interactions with unarmed civilians, where unarmed civilians end up dead. And so it's horrifying. I watched the video before the broadcast, and Mr. Zeferino just looks confused, really seems not to have a sense of what's going on, and then the police open fire on him and kill him. And so the fact that the Department of Law, the LAPD, or the Gardena, I'm sorry, PD, needed to make a settlement with the families to deal with these deaths, with the death and with the wounding of the other man, really shows that there's a considerable interest by the public, that the public does have a right to know what's going on. These are taxpayer dollars that are being used to cover up the wrongdoing of police officers who are behaving in a manner that's completely inappropriate. And so it's a horrifying situation, but it is encouraging to see this information finally becoming available to the public.
Courtney, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Bye, Sonali.
Courtney Morris is an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. A new United Nations report has found that women worldwide earn significantly less than men, even though they're working longer hours. Despite the growing visibility of women in higher tiers of the corporate world, by and large, women are nowhere close to achieving wage parity. Here in the United States, women are ranked 65th in wage parity, as raised by presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in her recent address to the Women in the World Summit in New York City. Now, Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, details the myriad ways in which women are being thrown, quote, under the bus, which is actually the title of her new book. Caroline Fredrickson is also a senior fellow at Demos and has written about many important constitutional issues. She's also the former director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and was general counsel and legal director of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Welcome to Uprising, Caroline.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be on.
Now, broadly speaking, I suppose we shouldn't at all be surprised at the global state of women's workplace inequality. It's this concrete measure of historical sexism that's been around probably as long as our species has, right?
Well, you know, it's hard to know actually how much has been around since the beginning and how much we've just seen happen through culture and discrimination and so forth. So I always hesitate to sort of agree to that kind of a scenario because it makes it sound almost like it's a natural occurrence and that it's built into the genders.
Right. Now, your book focuses primarily on women in the U.S. and as the world's supposedly most wealthy and advanced nation, a beacon for democracy and equality, is it all the more shocking given how low we rank on a global scale for things like women's wages? And in fact, where are we on the global scale?
Well, you know, I think it's very true. We are not nearly as high as we'd like to think we are. And I think it surprised me, actually, when I started looking into some of the issues. You know, we have a number of reasons why we don't rank as high. One is that we don't do anything in terms of childcare, really. We have the most minimal provisions for women, lower income women, but only 18% of eligible children even qualify for what our government provides. That's a vast majority of this, those children who are even in that low income level who can't get in, which affects their mothers very deeply in terms of what kind of jobs they can have, what kind of training and education. And then, of course, we don't have paid family leave, except for the very few, the very lucky, the upper levels of income, and mostly white women, honestly. And actually, men are the ones who most benefit from paid family leave, which is the irony. But then beyond that, in terms of wages, we have not addressed some very important issues of the statutory framework that we have. And this is where I was sort of most surprised, that we think we have this great set of laws that protects women against discrimination, that provides a minimum wage and overtime. But in fact, there are large groups of women who are not protected by those laws. And that leads to a lot of perverse outcomes, such as women who are in domestic work, getting worked far more hours than they should be, not making any overtime, not even making a minimum wage. At least not as required by law. And so you have these groups of women who are really falling behind. And no surprise, they tend to be women of color, and many of them are immigrant women.
You open your book telling the story of your own grandmother, a poor immigrant woman. And, you know, it's easy to sort of lose ourselves in the statistics. But tell us a little bit about that story and why it was sort of a personal inspiration for you.
Well, you know, it was it was my great-grandmother came from Sweden, and she was came on her own in her teens, very, very poor. And, you know, I just think it's a story that is very true for a lot of Americans. When we lose sight of that, we lose sight of the fact that there are more and more people coming in who still face these same situations, and particularly for the domestic workers. And my great-grandmother worked in a fancy rich people's house in Boston. She was a scullery maid, kind of the lowest level of person in the kitchen. She didn't speak any English. And people say to me, well, doesn't that show you that the American dream is still true? And that, you know, why do we need all this government help when your own story tells that people can move forward? Well, I have a few answers to that. One is, well, my great-grandparents were all white. They were all Northern European. They were all Protestant. But also the thing that people forget is that my great-grandfather was a working man. And when my great-grandmother met my great-grandfather, he was a Teamster. And there were actually ways that people could have decent paying jobs even without being educated, and really move themselves up in the world. Those jobs don't exist anymore. Our union movement has fallen apart. And I think it's actually an example of why some people were able to rise at a certain point in time. And we don't have that structure. It's one reason why I talk about unions in my book, because I think they have been such an important part of helping working families, and particularly women, better their situations. But they are just so weakened now by the continued onslaught from the right. And I certainly think it should be a major focus of policies to figure out how to improve people's access to organizing.
So on the issue of unions, we know that there's a strong correlation between union representation and overall wages being higher for those people who are unionized. But what about wage parity? Do women represented by a union tend to have wages that are more equal to the men in that union? Or do we know
absolutely
that data?
Absolutely. No, it's absolutely women who are in organized jobs who have a union have much closer wage parity. Not only that, but they have much better benefits. They have much more flexibility in their schedules, much more likely to have paid leave. So in all of the variables that we talked about before about why it is that American women don't rate as high as women in many other countries in the world because of the policies that we follow in the United States, unions are the counter to that. If more women were unionized, we would actually rank much higher.
Now, how disproportionately represented are women in not just low-wage industries, but also tipped industries? On our program, we had had a real close look at how tipped workers are being thrown under the bus, to paraphrase mm-hmm. your book title, even compared to other low-wage workers in the fight for a higher minimum wage. But it's often, or it's a majority women, I understand, that are part of the tipped workforce.
Absolutely. Absolutely, more than a majority. It's almost three quarters. And most of those workers are in the restaurant industry, which is not surprising, but they're also, you know, they work at hair salons and manicurists and so forth. And the ugly reality is that we haven't raised the tip minimum wage since the early 1990s. It's $2.13 an hour. I mean, people don't even seem to realize that. And when I tell them that, it just produces this look of incredible surprise that somehow that could be the wage that anyone in the United States would make. But we forget that. And I think many people forget that when they go out to eat and they go to a restaurant. Particularly if you're in one of where most of the women dominate is in these sort of casual restaurants. It's a macaroni grill or a place like that. People don't really think about leaving a tip. But we shouldn't actually expect these workers to have to, depend on people feeling particularly generous that day. You know, the idea that there's not just a base minimum wage for all workers, and in fact, it should be much higher, far more higher than it is, and that's why I'm very taken by the fight for 15. But even if we can get to 12, that'll bring people up somewhat. But we cannot leave the tipped workers behind.
Because that's leaving women behind.
It's absolutely now, leaving women behind.
What about, you mentioned manicurists. The New York Times recently had this lengthy expose on the nail industry in New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. The reporter, Sarah Maslin-Neer, found that, quote, among the more than 100 workers interviewed by the Times, and this is of the workers in New York that she interviewed, only about a quarter said that they were paid an amount that was the equivalent of New York State's minimum hourly wage. All but three workers, however, had wages withheld in other ways that would be considered illegal, such as never getting overtime. I'm guessing you're not very surprised by these findings.
I'm not. And actually, most of them aren't even entitled to overtime. It just happens to be, different examples. But when if you work for a small business or your particular independent contractors, a lot of manicurists and women who work at hair salons are actually treated as independent contractors. So they're not even guaranteed overtime. I think New York is more protective in that regard. But that is absolutely common. One of the big problems with the tipped minimum wage is that the enforcement is very complicated, because what has to happen in theory is that a worker is entitled to a minimum wage. But with tipped workers, what we're assuming is that somehow between the tips that they get will bring them up to the minimum wage. Whereas sometimes you have employers, restaurants that will say, oh, you actually made more than the minimum wage, so we're going to withhold some of your pay because you shouldn't make more than the minimum wage. But in fact, there are many, many occasions, and there have been a lot of lawsuits that document this, not enough, unfortunately, because so many women are not being paid their wages, but that show that it is certainly a good bet for companies not to sort of fill in above the tipped employee to the minimum wage level, because it's so hard to enforce that almost always the employer is going to be getting work at almost slave labor prices.
Right. And of course, many, many women, perhaps the majority in, for example, the nail industry, which we were just talking about, are also immigrant women. How are particularly undocumented women in the country faring in terms of wages? They have that added layer of vulnerability of being undocumented.
No, absolutely right. It's really complicated. Because for many women, it's not just that they're afraid, because if they bring issues forward that they might lose their jobs, which they depend on so desperately, and they might, in fact, lose their be they're undocumented, they might come and be turned over to the to ICE for deportation. But there are also laws, some of our so-called protective laws actually do not provide protections to undocumented workers at all. And so even were they to come forward, there would be no protection for them. So it is really a completely perverse system that we should recognize that workers have rights and keep our immigration questions and enforcement issues in terms of our border separate from worker protections. Because if you don't, and if they start to mix, then all of a sudden we get these very perverse incentives where employers really have workers over a barrel. They'll hire undocumented workers, and then they can threaten to deport them if an undocumented worker dares to raise issues about not being paid a minimum wage or getting overtime. And one area where this really plays out is in sexual harassment. And particularly for immigrant women, they work in a lot of types of jobs like farm work, domestic work, where they are highly subject to sexual harassment. And the obvious problem is they're not protected by the law, and they are highly dependent on their employer. And there have been some really, really heartbreaking reports documenting the types of sexual assault and even rape that happened to women with really no recourse.
Now, Caroline, we just talked about tipped workers. There's also temp workers. And in your book, you talk about the rise of the permanent temp. How serious a problem is this, and how vulnerable are women workers when they're essentially just kept on temporarily indefinitely?
Well, this is an issue that I hope we can build common cause across genders and race, because this is the issue of now and of the future. The rise of the temp workers is a phenomenon in which more and more companies are hiring temps when they have a decently paid workforce, and they start creating a two-tier workforce, and they bring on temps through temp agencies that hire them at lower wages and lower benefits. And this has happened with some of the big car companies in the South. Nissan is somewhat infamous for having the majority of its workers in Tennessee are actually temp workers. And so what it does, it bifurcates the workforce, but not just in terms of wages, but also in terms of general protections for workers, because temp workers are also, and this is really, as you can see, it's a major theme of my book, but the exemptions that we have in our laws allow employers to really manipulate the status of employees. And that's whether you're called an independent contractor or a temp worker or a part-time worker, that those kinds of designations really allow the employer to reduce the number of workers they have to protect against discrimination, that they have to provide a minimum wage to or overtime, or that are allowed to even join a union. And so women are obviously, we are the ones who are most vulnerable. And so this group of temp workers there are very many women. But we really need to wrestle with this in the United States, because this is a pattern and a paradigm that more employers are adopting, and more and more men are going to be affected by this.
And actually, on this issue of men versus women, how do you respond to those who might say, well, all workers are suffering in this economy, that we should be fighting for all workers' rights? Why are you just pointing out the fact that women workers are being screwed over, thrown under the bus?
Well, exactly. And I pointed out because, as I said, I think women are the canary in the coal mine. Women have experienced more quickly and more deeply the types of fragmentations in our workplace that are now becoming more and more mainstream. And so I raise this because the kinds of exemptions that have affected women, including categories of workers who are left out of our labor protections, those kinds of jobs are the jobs that are becoming more and more prevalent in the American economy. So a lot of service jobs are the ones that the Department of Labor has identified as the fastest growing and the ones that are likely to have the most number of employees going forward. So, I think that looking out for women who are, by the way, the 51%. So I think when you start caring about women workers, you are actually caring about the majority of workers. But really, these types of trends are expanding. And employers are exploiting them. And so, I really think it's an opportunity through calling attention to sort of the origins of many of these holes in our labor protections, which come out of a history of racism and misogyny. But looking at that and then sort of seeing where it goes, you see more and more employers taking advantage of these kinds of loopholes that were created initially during the New Deal to make sure that African Americans living in the South couldn't take advantage of the right to organize or get a minimum wage. Hmm.
Caroline Fredrickson is my guest, and we're talking about her book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to discuss some of the corporate responses to women's conditions in the workplace. We've heard of leaning in or opting out. Stay tuned. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We turn back to our guest, Caroline Fredrickson. She's the president of the American Constitution Society. Her new book is called Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Caroline, let's talk about the corporate response to the crisis of women who are working and getting thrown under the bus. It's best exemplified by Facebook executive Sheryl Sandberg, whose 2013 book, Lean In, asserted that it's, you know, women's fault if they're getting left behind in the economy, and if they only leaned in and acted maybe more like men and became more aggressive, they would do better. Now, as you can tell, I sort of detest this patronizing approach. What is your response?
Well, you know, so I do think there are some issues that Sheryl Sandberg raises that we should encourage more conversation about in a broader sense of the kind of cultural constraints that women grow up with. I think, you know, the sort of the way that women are discouraged from succeeding, from being smart, the whole, you know, something I was always sensitive to as a kid, but the dumb blonde kind of perspective that women are labeled with if they whether they try and be smart or they hide their intelligence. But there are certainly, so I give her credit for putting that out there. But when she and the conversation that was going on between her and Anne Marie Slaughter, in some sense, I think it was a conversation in the sense that people were hearing the lean in message, and then there was a counter message called the opt out message, which
right.
Anne Marie Slaughter sort of exemplified about how for women, you know, this was, you know, high striving women could not be both successful in the workplace and have a successful home life. And what just really frustrated me about the conversation was that there was so much taken for granted, and that was all women are upper middle class white women with a graduate degree in some kind of profession who are married and have children and are trying to figure out how to, you know, how many nannies they should hire and, you know, and how they should deal with the house cleaner. And, you know, as well as, you know, as Sheryl Sandberg, you know, I really do feel terrible for her with her loss of her husband.
Right, yes, of course.
Which she does say is how important it is to have a partner who is supportive of you. And I fully endorse that viewpoint. And I, you know, I'm very sorry for her loss.
But her husband just recently passed away in a freak accident. Yeah. Well, and actually, the point, of course, is that women who want to be mothers, even in, it seems as in the upper middle class to, you know, the one percenters, are essentially being forced to stay at home and or choosing, in this case, opting out to stay at home because they can afford to. They might have husbands or be independently wealthy. But we started our conversations talking about how such a huge reason why there, you know, why women are really being hurt in this economy is because of the lack of support for many women who want to be mothers. There's almost no maternity leave that's required, depending on the state you live in. Childcare is so unaffordable. So can you focus on that a little bit and how those women who might have the option of opting out really have to worry about this?
Well, you know, thank you, Sonali, for that question. And one of the things that I was really amazed by in doing the research for Under the Bus was looking into the history of childcare in our country. And one of the issues around motherhood that is really so interesting and probably won't take any of the listeners by surprise because it's so intuitively obvious. But, you know, we have a really, I would say, hypocritical view of motherhood in this country, in that we have very much celebrated the stay-at-home mom, the kind of, you know, traditional woman wearing an apron and baking pies, who's there for her 3, 4, 5, or 6 kids. But that woman and that mother is a white woman, and father knows best, you know, the Mayberry, you think of all those kind of classic American TV shows. But we've had another view of motherhood that has affected low-wage women of color, and that is this kind of welfare queen, lazy women, you know, and the whole welfare reform effort that was really structured to push women into the workplace, even if they were a single mom, even with if they had very young kids, even without providing them with training, with support, with, you know, support to pay for transportation to a job, and all of those things. And we've kind of maintained this duality in our perception of women. And that has played into the childcare issue in the United States, because we did experiment with childcare during World War II. It was a very small program. It was poorly run and underfunded. And it was only put in place because those kind of women, those mothers, white mothers, were in the factories because we needed it for the war effort. And so it was still not celebrated. Rosie the Riveter, by the way, doesn't seem like she was a mom, because all of the conversation about mothers at the time was really about how mothers shouldn't be working unless they really had to. Women need to be in the workforce, but mothers preferably not. So there was this very small program which was immediately dissolved at the end of World War II, and men came back and women were pushed out of those factory jobs and back into low-paid jobs if they were in the workforce at all. And then there was another experiment, and this is so fascinating. In the 70s, there was an effort to establish a child care expansion that would have included more than Head Start includes, to have a broader base of families, and really, you know, sort of up into middle income families who would have been able to benefit from starting to create a kind of extension of our public school system. But the same groups that organized to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment organized to defeat the child care law.
Of course, right.
And there was this group, and this is, you know, it's sort of funny, except that the consequences are so tragic, but there was a group called the 4 W's, which meant women who want to be women. Literally,
wow.
This was, and they were active in the ERA fight, and they led the charge in getting President Nixon to veto the legislation. They described how these terrible feminists were going to be breaking down the family and taking their husbands away from them and perverting their children and, you know, and all sorts of crazy things. But, you know, as a result, the women who really needed this help, women who can't opt out, and to go back to that conversation, the real needs for childcare are not for the women who struggle with, you know, should I stay home or should I work? And it's a choice. What are the sort of cultural issues? And but it's for the women who really don't have a choice. I have no problems with women who want to stay home and raise their children at home. If that is really a choice, that's great. But what worries me a lot more is the women who don't have a choice at all, because they really have to, they need the money. And when childcare is so phenomenally expensive in this country and so unavailable for low income families, we have a real situation, because, you know, as I looked into some of the data for Under the Bus, I looked at the Department of Labor data on childcare arrangements, and they have a whole category that's called self-care. So I'm sure I don't need to spell that out for the viewers what that
self-care
means.
Self-care.
Yes, it's just, I could not believe the euphemism. When we're talking about leaving kids alone, it is a phenomenon that was documented at the beginning of the 20th century when people used to chain their kids to the tables so they could go off to the factories, because they couldn't really put them anywhere, and there wasn't accessible childcare. Well, we're still in that situation. People may not be chaining their kids to the table, but they don't have anywhere to put them if they can't find family members to take care of them. It's a desperate struggle to pay the extraordinary cost of childcare.
My guest is Caroline Fredrickson. She's a president of the American Constitution Society, and her book is called Under the Bus, about how working women are being treated by the U.S. economy. This is Uprising. When we come back, actor and activist Mimi Kennedy joins us to discuss the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Democratic Party presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is heading to Phoenix, Arizona this weekend to address the Netroots Nation Conference, a large annual gathering of progressives. After that, he'll speak at the major convention center in Phoenix that only weeks ago was filled with 5,000 Americans supporting the bigotry-tainted campaign of Donald Trump. Already 3,000 people have registered to see Sanders, which is not surprising given that he has drawn the largest crowds to date of any presidential candidate from any political party. Sanders has surprised both the right and the left with his ascension, mostly because he's been willing to articulate simple yet specific solutions to the problem of wealth inequality. He wants to increase taxes on the wealthy, while his closest rival, Hillary Clinton, has touted tax credits for middle-class families. Sanders has openly talked about wealth redistribution being far more important than growth, while Clinton, unwilling to shift on the Democratic Party neoliberal orthodoxy, has insisted that wage growth must go hand in hand with economic growth. What Democrats fear is that Sanders will pull Clinton so far to the left that she will be an unviable candidate in the 2016 general election. Republicans have been openly happy about Sanders possibly having such an impact. But before the lesser of two evils logic starts tamping down Democratic desires, the question remains, is Bernie Sanders the candidate that Americans have been waiting for? Joining me to help answer that question is Mimi Kennedy. She's an actor who rose to fame with her role as Abby O'Neill on ABC's Dharma and Greg. She stars as Marjorie Armstrong in the CBS sitcom Mom. Her film credits include Erin Brockovich, Midnight in Paris, and The Five-Year Engagement. She's also a longtime progressive activist and currently the board chair of Progressive Democrats of America. And she recently hosted Sanders' campaign stop in Southern California. Welcome to Uprising, Mimi.
Thank you, Sonali. It's an honor to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, a certain sector of the Democratic Party has been counting on Hillary Clinton as the nominee and eventually president for a long time, since 2008, mostly because she's a woman and she carries this veneer of liberal politics. But are you throwing your support behind Bernie Sanders?
Yes, because we've been working for a candidate like Bernie Sanders as a progressive Democrat. I guess it was since the year 2000 when I really think that the country was driven into a ditch by a drunk driver. I just thought it is time to step up. Things have to change. And I was concentrating as I could on the peace movement locally, Office of the Americas, Blaise Bonpain, trying to act on what I had always thought. And by 2004, Dennis Kucinich had asked me to help with his campaign because of the Department of Peace. And I wouldn't compare, by the way, the two candidacies. Mm-hmm. That's the only way I'm going to mention Dennis. Dennis's name. But those were bleak days for our country. So Progressive Democrats of America started in 2004 when Kerry, John Kerry, was not going to carry opposition to the war as central to his campaign. And how ironic, beautifully that's actually turned out just recently. He made a statement going, this is who I always was, the guy who made this deal, and talked and talked and talked with our supposed enemies until we now...
You're talking about the Iran nuclear
deal. A hand of at least verifiable cooperation. But at any rate, Progressive Democrats of America, formed by Tim Carpenter, decided to change the Democratic Party from the inside. And we would go to these conventions. I was just telling you off camera about some of those. And working locally, you know, in Democratic clubs and stuff, to just come in and invite progressives in and younger people in and women in on the theory that if we're the party's candidates will change. And voila. What's interesting is Bernie wasn't even in the Democratic Party.
Right. He's been an independent senator
in
Vermont.
That's right. And caucusing with the Democrats. Right. They all know him.
Yeah.
He's not been a maniac rogue person like, say, Donald Trump. But he is an independent.
And he has very strong progressive roots. He is somebody who has a history, although he doesn't talk about it very much, of being very active. He was active in the civil rights movement. He was active in a lot of movements.
Very much so. He's a movement guy. That's why he's so authentic. That's why 10,000 people want to hear him speak, because this is not just a typed up speech that he gives over and over. He's very responsive. He's a movement guy. And socialist, you know, he's been...
Let's talk about
socialist.
The S.
Oh, society is so bad. I want to be all alone and never have anybody. You know, as a socialist, he has long believed in the vision, not in any particular nation's expression of it, certainly, but in the vision of mutual help. Well, look at the Constitution and the preamble, you know, in order to help with our common welfare. That's the deal.
He describes himself as a democratic socialist, which, you know, I imagine he is probably has more in common with Scandinavian politics of social democrats, someone who wants strong controls on capital in the interest of income equality. Of course, the Republican Party will seize on this label with glee and want to paint him as a Soviet-style autocrat. Not yet. Right now, they're quite happy to see him suck votes away from Hillary Clinton. But, I mean, if you look at what they did to Obama, who has not ever labeled himself a socialist, has never really done much to deserve that term, they're going to seize upon this and claim he wants to take everyone's freedoms away and abolish private property, because, of course, that's what socialism means
to
Republicans.
That is what they'll say. I'm proud to think, whether it's true or not, I do believe the country has changed. I think the Republican... a message machine has been revealed for the lying, myth-making, racist, bigoted thing that it is. And so Bernie, first of all, Bernie is not an African-American, and one of the reasons that Obama was so excoriated was this fear of race. It was hideous. You know, Bernie looks like your old, if you're a white person, it's your uncle at the dinner table. He's an old white guy. That's what he looks like in the casting call. And beyond that image thing, to which negative things might not stick as much for the low-informed voter, I think there are fewer low-informed voters. I really think the American people now are worthy of the credit we'd like to give ourselves.
And maybe that word is just not as scary to the public as it used to be. And the Republican Party might mistakenly think that the word socialist could scare off a lot of people. But given how terribly people have been doing in this country, how horribly big wage inequality is and income inequality is, I can see why Americans, or some Americans, might be changing their minds, thinking, why not try socialism?
Well, they personally suffered. You know, socialism was confusing to me as a kid. I understand communism was bad in the things that I was told.
Yeah.
But both the Nazis and the communists who supposedly were fighting each other. I mean, this is my very bad history education as a parochial schoolgirl. But they both had socialist attached to their names. Yeah. So it didn't have much meaning for me. And the meaning that it has now is all positive.
Yeah. Well, it might actually end up removing us. If his candidacy does even one minimal thing, it might be to remove the stigma associated with the word socialist. And let's talk about his other sort of bread and butter issues, just to spell it out. $15 an hour in minimum wage, single-payer health care, I understand, free tuition for higher education. What else does Bernie stand for?
Repeal as far as we can Glass-Steagall? How'd that be? He voted against Glass-Steagall back when Clinton and the neoliberal experiment with the Democratic Party was all, had everybody agog, and Bernie went, no, that's gambling with the people's money that they think is safe in the bank, in order to have unlimited cancerous growth of capital. So repeal Glass-Steagall, work to repeal Citizens United, the idea of corporate persons. Bernie is he often says it's a political revolution, and he's got movement politics in the sense that a Robin Hood tax, a tiny tax on these lightning fast electronic trades that only make billions for the traders and nothing for investors. In fact, they undermine safe investment for your child's college education. And we should be so lucky if we're able to put any aside. But he also says it's a political revolution. He's interested in democracy. He's interested in getting America back to a democracy because he knows as it's controlled by the money, it's going to be fewer and fewer people voting, paying attention, and the rest of us are going to be lulled to sleep by show business. So I would say that Bernie is a democratic candidate small d for sure.
Now he's been drawing huge crowds, and it's not surprising that that would happen in states like Vermont, but also Wisconsin and Portland, Maine. His numbers, poll numbers in Iowa and New Hampshire, which are crucial swing states, have gotten pretty close to Clinton, dangerously close from her perspective to Clinton's. Aren't these states mostly white electorate states, even if there are, say, immigrant or Latino populations, if you look at the voting public? So maybe it's not surprising yet. And will a true test of Bernie Sanders' viability as the nominee be in states like California, Arizona, Nevada?
I agree, which is why it's great he's going to go to Arizona, and 3,000 people have already signed up. They'll be getting those non-RSVP he's in there too. I just read the speech that he gave to La Raza.
The National Council of La Raza.
Yeah, La Raza. And,
despite its name, a very
conservative. It's very centrist. By now, because it has a name from many, many years ago that happens to all of us. we've moved on. But anyway, he was just asking about an ethnic voting bloc. Here are people that have been identity politics doing that for a while as a very smart strategic voting strategy. Let's inform our people. And he got twice as much applause as Hillary Clinton did. And I looked at the speech, and it was pretty thrilling. I mean, it's the Dream Act. It's everything that Arizonans were marching. I remember going and marching there against 1070. Once you get into presidential politics, you are dealing with older organizations, more centrist organizations. That's why I didn't we tried to change the Democratic Party from the inside, where it wasn't so old, where the grassroots were just coming up now. Bernie is kind of the flowering of this. But when you ask the question, and this comes up always, and they're going to vote this, the Latinos are going to vote that, separating, Bernie doesn't like all that. And yet, of course, when he's actually addressing it, at this point, the American people, 99% of us are all those organizations. And what is required is an authentic economic response to people's suffering and environmental response to people's suffering, because it's bad enough in the capital markets now because of the gambling that's gone on. But the environment is going to be a big issue.
And he's strong on climate change. But on this issue of, for example, specifically black and brown voters, these are constituencies that have fairly faithfully given their votes to the Democratic Party. Among black and brown constituencies, Hillary Clinton has massive name recognition. The New York Times did a piece about Sanders' supposed unpopularity among black voters, simply because they may not know who he is. And then the LA Times did a piece on how Latino voters support Clinton so much more. Do you think that he's cognizant as a candidate of how he does need to win over these constituencies?
Well, I'm sure he is. I don't think that the campaign is filled with the Joe Trippies and the James Carvilles of the world. I'm not sure they're thinking in those terms. They're trying to introduce Bernie to people who don't know him. That's what I tried to do at my front yard. And when they know him, they go, oh, my God, this guy is authentic. And then you go back to his past and you see that he was down in Mississippi. You see, you know, that that's what he was doing as a young man. Then you realize this guy's been doing this all his life under an independent banner. And we begged him to run as a Democrat. I think you're going to ask a question about the third party thing. No.
Yes, I will ask if we have time about the Green Party but other independent other parties. But let's also talk about one issue that comes up often, and I think legitimately so, on Sanders. Recalcitrance among progressives with Sanders is about Israel. On the issue of Israel, last year he shocked many people. Last summer, this was just as the brutal Israeli war on Gaza was just wrapping up, and he defended Israeli aggression on Gaza at this event that was videotaped. He says he believes in a two-state solution. He's visited Israel many times. He's lived on a kibbutz. Is he what people would call a PEP, a PEP, a progressive except Palestine?
Except for Palestine.
Because that is a concern.
You know, having bumped into a lot of the PEPs, he's not, in my opinion. I mean, I'm not a spokesperson for the campaign, but in my opinion, having worked for 12 years and always running into this, which to me leads to what I call warmongering. Because if you're going to take one stand and never move, where are we? Except for we're going to have perpetual war. And why? It doesn't benefit anybody, including Israel. So he's different. He's different. I like that he did not go to Netanyahu's speech. He eventually called the Gaza thing disproportionate. You know.
Do you think he can be
mild
moved?
To us? But right. You know,
can he be moved on the issue of Israel? Because
I think
if there's
definitely
room for movement, progressives,
you know, one thing I
might have some hope.
He wanted. He was supportive of the Palestinians' moves at the UN for statehood. As was I. I thought this was really going to be the moment where Palestine became state, whether anybody liked it or not. And he was supportive of that. And of course, our government managed to quash it and obstruct it. But if he were president and he were supportive, that would be a change for our policy. So I do believe, and I think that the legislative director of the Jewish Voice for Peace, I just read that he's more hopeful. I can only say from my experience, he is nothing like the Democrats, who are progressive on everything.
I mean, and if you compare, right,
Israel.
Yeah, if you compare specifically Hillary Clinton's statements
very
on
much
Israel,
so.
She basically is in bed with Netanyahu. Let's also talk about the issue of gun control, which might be another possible disappointment for progressives. Last week at a campaign event, and this just came up, an activist with the group Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, this activist asked Sanders about his position on gun control. She specifically asked him why he voted in favor of a bill that prevented gun manufacturers from ever being sued. And this is how he defended it. It's a lengthy quote. He said, "I come from a state where tens and tens of thousands of people hunt and do target practice. I understand that guns in my state are different than guns in Chicago or Los Angeles. People in urban America have got to appreciate that the overwhelming majority of people who hunt know about guns and respect guns and are law-abiding people. That's the truth. And people in rural America have got to understand that in urban area, guns mean something very, very different." I wasn't quite sure where he was going with that, but, you know, so
sounds
soon
like
after.
Sounds like he'd certainly be for local control. Like, wasn't Chicago passed, they banned guns from the city environs. I'm trying to remember this, and I'm not sure I have it right. But then, of course, it goes immediately to court, and the NRA says you don't have the right to do that as a locality. Well, it would seem to me that if Bernie Sanders were president, he would definitely appoint Supreme Court justices who knew the difference between being Chicago and wanting to ban guns in the city environs and have them in Vermont. That's, again, not a spokesperson for the campaign, but after 12 years of activism, I'd be okay with that.
Well, he has a mixed record on gun control. There have been times he has voted in favor of gun control and other times that he hasn't. And, you know, certainly having a realistic assessment of any candidate is important for all of us with our eyes open.
Absolutely.
He just a couple of things. In 1993, he voted against a Brady background check bill, which was disappointed a lot of folks.
Yeah,
and he voted to allow guns in checked bags on Amtrak. And which is one thing I was surprised by. After the Sandy Hook massacre, he told a magazine, "If you pass the strongest gun control legislation tomorrow, I don't think it will have a profound effect on the tragedies we have seen." It sounds like Vermont might have cocooned him a little bit.
Got a big NRA thing up there. I don't know. That'd be a great place for progressives to pressure a
Mimi, if you help
Sanders
me get an interview with Sanders, I will ask him that question directly. Let's talk about Jill Stein of the Green Party. She is considered the presumptive nominee of the Green Party. For a long time, progressives, including progressive Democrats, have, you know, shown support for the Green Party. She ran for governor of California. There's been, I understand, some conflict within the Green Party between people who are backing Sanders versus Stein. What do you make of that?
Well, again, PDA started in order to get Greens into the Democratic Party because the third party effort in United States of America is too expensive for grassroots activists to be able to handle. So we've said we're going to try something different. We're going to try to use the money and the leverage of the Democratic Party to be Greens or Green-like. And so I think that the party, I'm not inside the Green Party. And I think that they're great people. But I do believe, I have nothing to say about that other than I know that I have always argued with everybody, don't do a third party progressive thing because the Republicans commit election fraud anyway.
Well,
they're thrilled to have a reason to make it look like they're winning when they're really not.
If Sanders doesn't win the Democratic nomination but ends up running independently, and actually maybe I should ask you this, will he end up running independently?
I don't think he will. I think
he'll back out.
Very well.
He doesn't want to be Nader.
No, and he doesn't. Why do you run for president? I mean, are you trying to? Sarah Palin did it so she could be famous in show business. I understand that kind of desperation. I wouldn't have chosen that path. But she, he would have no reason to do that, I don't think. The idea of I want to give someone somebody to vote for, if it's ultimately going to elect a Republican administration that's going to take us to war again, perpetual war, income inequality, not repeal Glass-Steagall, Citizens United remains. Why would anybody do that for egotistic reasons? I don't think Bernie Sanders would.
Well, there's also a Democratic candidate that no one's talking about. His name is Martin O'Malley, former governor of Maryland. The Atlantic said he might be the most ignored candidate of 2016. And they said he ought to be a Democrat's dream candidate. In two terms, as the governor of Maryland, he ushered in a sweeping liberal agenda that includes gay marriage, gun control, an end to the death penalty, in-state college tuition for undocumented immigrants. What's not to like?
Yeah, it sounds like Bernie's agenda. I don't know. That word ought. You ought to like him. Now you ought to vote for the one I say.
And I'm just wondering suspicious. If his main issue is just lack of name recognition.
I think he's from Delaware, and I think that a lot of the Northeast Democratic Party is very in bed with banking and credit card money, and that's what I think. And I bet he's a great guy, and I want to see his donors, and then I'll know more about him.
Mimi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, you're welcome.
Mimi Kennedy is an actor and activist, and she is she recently hosted Bernie Sanders' campaign stop in Southern California. She's the board chair of Progressive Democrats of America. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Kiana Turner is our visual editor and research intern. Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Jonathan Alexander for technical assistance. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprising with Sonali. Your subscription sustains the TV production of Uprising. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Ketsal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.